Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Let the record show that the witnesses answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and please be seated.
That was Democratic Representative Adam Schiff swearing in the witnesses yesterday at the first in a series of live public hearings as part of the impeachment process related to President Donald Trump. At the heart of the issue is whether the president withheld or threatened to withhold congressionally approved financial aid to Ukraine as leverage to get a foreign country to investigate a political rival for Trump's own personal gain, not the United States' interests. Yesterday, we heard from diplomats Bill Taylor and George Kent. Taylor is the acting ambassador to Ukraine. He was asked to step in by Mike Pompeo after President Trump asked for the previous ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch's, removal. Kent is Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, responsible for Ukraine. Both are long-serving diplomats and, by all reports, are highly respected within government and diplomatic circles. Now, you may already be tired of hearing about this, or perhaps you're glued to the news. Either way, we're just at the beginning. There will be more testimony tomorrow from Yovanovitch herself and a planned 3 days of hearings next week. So let's take a moment here to talk about where things stand and to answer any questions you might have about the process, either the impeachment procedure itself or the politics overlaid onto the constitutional process. Joining us today is Dartmouth College Government Professor Linda Fowler. Professor Fowler, thank you very much for coming back to talk with us.
Hi, Jane.
So I understand you did not watch all 6 hours of live testimony yesterday, but you're certainly read into everything that's been going on. Do you think the American public has the time to sit through 6 hours yesterday, you know, maybe 6 hours tomorrow and, what, 18 hours next week? I mean, how useful is this public process to the American people?
Well, I'm a believer that the legislature needs to use its oversight powers to investigate the executive branch when there are sufficient facts uncovered to suggest that something is amiss. So to some extent, I think the hearings are important for the lawmakers themselves. We've had hearings behind closed doors, and the judgment after those hearings was that there was sufficient information really revealed that there should be public hearings. So for some members of Congress, this is new. I think for some members of the Trump administration to see all of the evidence being laid out in a systematic way is may be effective and certainly influence their actions. So the fact that the American public isn't glued to the TV for 6 hours a day or 10 hours a day, I think, is not really the major question. Like most of us, we have our lives to lead, and we delegate this responsibility to our lawmakers.
When you talk about that, delegating the responsibility to our lawmakers, I have to admit I've been feeling a little cynical since watching everything yesterday and listening to all of the testimony and feeling like the lawmakers who were involved, it seems like in the tone of their questions, have already made up their mind about how they feel about this process. And so I'm wondering, you know, not what the value is of holding hearings, but you know, for the cynical people among us who say, look, why even bother? Everybody who has a voice to have, you know, to be in this process has already made up their minds, and no new testimony is going to change their minds. If they think that the process itself is a witch hunt, there's no new testimony that's going to change their mind. If they think that the president has been breaking the law and has been terrible from the start, there's probably no changing their mind. So why bother? Is this just a charade?
No, it's not a charade. And in fact, I think both parties would rather that this wasn't happening at all. The Democrats avoided establishing a formal impeachment inquiry for a very long time, and the Republicans certainly would wish this would go away. But there are 535 members of Congress. There are senators, there are House members who, unlike the people in the committee room yesterday, who were members of a single committee, the Intelligence Committee, a lot of people may have been following the hearings from day to day. This members have certainly been talking about it among themselves. But to have the story laid out in a systematic, coherent way, and to provide an opportunity for Republicans to poke holes in the argument, I think that's the first time we've actually seen this all in one place. And I think that's useful for everybody, even the cynics.
Let's listen to what Peter Welch said first yesterday, because he sort of laid out what he saw as the sort of central question of the impeachment inquiry. So let's listen to what Peter Welch had to say.
The question for us is whether the use of power by the president was for the benefit of advancing his political interest in the 2020 campaign. And by the way, my colleagues, if the president wants to attack Joe Biden and his son, he's free to do it, all fair and square in campaigns. He's just not free to change our foreign policy unless he gets his way to assist him in that campaign. That's a line he can't cross.
All right, so there's Peter Welch, Congressman Peter Welch, talking about what he sees as the central question. So, Professor Fowler, we've, as you might imagine, been hearing from people who have their own thoughts on this. Don wrote in to say, I have a question. What is the specific crime the president is accused of? I get it. He's rude, blunt, obnoxious to many. He won an election he wasn't remotely expected to win. But in America, we play fair. What is the specific crime and the U.S. statute he's accused of? So far, it's very nebulous with no facts, evidence, or firsthand testimony. So far, I've heard hearsay and opinions. And I'll read you also the responses that some listeners have given to Don, and then I'd love to get your take. So James says, try to keep up. He's accused of asking a foreign official to interfere in our election by investigating a potential rival. Even worse, if this behavior is allowed, the door is open for more of this in the future from any party. And Tom says, and he used taxpayer money that had been fully appropriated by Congress to extort that foreign government to investigate his rival. And he has lied about it. And he has obstructed justice and oversight by a co-equal branch of government, Congress. And he has behaved as though he is completely above the law, which, if allowed to stand, could be embraced by any future president of any party. But then Louis says, Democrats want to prosecute American citizens using hearsay evidence. So help us parse that, Professor Fowler.
Well, we've just had the basic party arguments outlined by both of your listeners. I think you have to start with the premise that the Constitution itself is unclear, as it is about many things. It uses the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors, as well as treason. And more specific things. So it's really left to Congress and precedent to decide what high crimes and misdemeanors might be. And I think that there is some suggestion that if the phone calls really were as described by the witnesses, that the president would be liable for criminal charges about soliciting bribes for something of value, which is information beneficial to his campaign, and also violation of campaign finance laws, and as well as the more, to me, the more problematic action is basically taking money that was duly appropriated by Congress, the $400 million in aid, and it was appropriated through bipartisan support, and basically deciding not to spend it. That was something Richard Nixon got into trouble with in his impeachment inquiry. So there are both legal issues about the specific actions that the president may have done, as well as the more profound constitutional implications of the president thwarting the will of a co-equal branch and then obstructing its ability to find out really what the facts are. It is true that nobody has got the president on tape ordering a specific political benefit And we had that debate when Nixon was being subjected to impeachment inquiries. And the question is whether the president has to be caught with a smoking gun of an actual crime or whether a broad pattern of behavior that's contrary to the spirit of the Constitution, which the framers would have thought of as a high crime and a violation of the oath of office to take care that the laws are executed. So in this case, you seem to have both constitutional violations as well as the potential for actual statutes being violated. We know, however, that the Justice Department has taken the position that a sitting president can't be prosecuted for a crime. And in fact, in the Mueller report, the specific recommendation was made that if Congress thinks the president has done something wrong, that had to do with inviting Russian interference in the 2000 election, then impeachment was the remedy.
You know, it's interesting, though. You said there's no smoking gun for the president. Now, people who say this is not a legitimate process also say the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, says there was no coercion. I didn't feel the pressure, and that the aid was eventually released. So what's the problem? And so from your reading of it, it's not necessarily did the crime happen, but was the person intending to do the bad thing that's at stake here?
Well, if you're looking at motivation, we don't have a direct order from the president, at least not yet. But of course, the people in the position to know whether there was a direct order, Mulvaney, Sondland, perhaps Giuliani, who's not even a government official, and perhaps John Bolton, those people have been prevented from testifying by the president. So he can't have it both ways. He can't say there's no smoking gun and then deny access to the people who had direct contact with him about this issue.
Let's go to our calls. Again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're talking about impeachment. You can just share your thoughts with us, your perception of the procedure, how you feel personally, or you can ask a question of our guest, government professor Linda Fowler. Joe is calling in from Isle LaMotte. Hi, Joe. Go right ahead.
Hi. So I listened to about 2 hours of the hearings yesterday. And I'm a progressive, so I'm not really a Democrat or a Republican. But I saw that basically it was two camps, that it was the Democrats were more concerned about our national interests or getting to the truth, and that Republicans were basically cared about party and keeping their – I mean, they brought up Hillary and Obama, and I kept on telling myself, what's this have to do with what the president did? So I wanted to say that, and I wanted to give a shout-out to Representative Welch. I think that he gave the best comment. People want to get to the truth on the Republican side, but they don't even want to put Trump where people can ask him questions on what he actually did and what happened to the tape and the secret server that the tape is stored on. There's just so many questions that the American people need to know, and the two camps are basically in two different worlds. One is for country and the other one's for party. That's my comment.
Well, Joe, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. And Joe referenced a comment by Vermont Representative Peter Welch that has really made a splash in a lot of different places. You could see it on some of the late night shows last night. They were talking about it. And let's play the exchange, because sometimes what's gotten a little bit lost in the Welch quote is what came before it, what he was referring to. So here's Republican Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, who was calling for the whistleblower to testify.
Now, there is one witness that they won't bring in front of us. They won't bring in front of the American people. And that's the guy who started it all, the whistleblower. Nope.
To which Representative Welch responded,
thank you. I say to my colleague, I'd be glad to have the person who started it all come in and testify. President Trump is welcome to take a seat right there.
And you can hear the response he got from the room. Let's go to Jenny, who's calling in from Mount Holly. Jenny, hi. Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment and a question, and one was basically mentioned a minute ago, the people who have been subpoenaed but will not talk until a judge has made a decision. When might that happen? What's holding it up? Is it even before a judge, or will it be 3 years from now when it won't matter? And also, I think the hearings are terribly important so people know the facts, so they know what to do when they are voting.
Well, I appreciate your perspective, Jenny. Thanks very much. And to your question, Linda Fowler, what about getting people to testify who say the White House has advised me not to testify? There have been legal questions about that. There have been requests to testify withdrawn. You know, it's all very confusing about who's going to testify when and how.
It is confusing because a few people have basically said they're serving two masters. They're obliged to testify, to respond to a subpoena from Congress, and they're obliged to follow the order of the president. And so they've brought a third branch of government, the courts, in to resolve this dispute. Because there is a case pending, and in response to your listener's question, it has to do with I think it's McGahn, who was head of the White House Counsel's Office for a while.
Mm-hmm. White House Counsel John McGahn.
Yeah, that case is about to be resolved. And so there was some effort on the part of Bolton and his deputy, whose name is escaping me right now, to basically say once there's a court decision, you know, will testify. And they had a lawsuit. So the McGahn lawsuit is close to being resolved, and it would establish a precedent that might be the kind of cover that Bolton and his deputy are looking for. There are other people, however, like Mulvaney, who simply said refused to testify. And it's been, I think, since the 1930s that Congress sent the sergeant of arms to take somebody into custody for failing to honor a subpoena. So if your listener is confused, I think she's got a lot of company because it is a very confusing thing. And that, of course, is part of the strategy of the Trump team is to clutter the news waves with so many competing narratives that the public just throws up its hands and said, oh, we'll work it out when the election comes.
Yes. And you mentioned that the name was escaping you of the deputy, Bolton's deputy, and it was escaping me, too. But luckily not the Vermont Edition producers, who remind us that Charles Kupperman is the former deputy security advisor to John Bolton.
I was going to say that, but then I thought I might be wrong.
You need my crack team, Linda. That's what you need.
I do.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Again, we're talking about the impeachment hearings, and we're getting a little bit of a pulse of the room here in Vermont, if Vermont can be considered a room, and in our listening audience. But also, Dartmouth College Government Professor Linda Fowler is helping us to answer some questions about both procedure and politics. So let's hear a little bit more from the hearings yesterday. Questioned by the Democrats' counsel Daniel Goldman, acting ambassador to Ukraine Bill Taylor described what he heard from Ukrainian officials about their understanding of what they had to do to receive security assistance from the United States.
Mr. Goldman, here's what I know. I got several questions. Other officials got several questions as well from Ukrainians asking about the security assistance. So what I know is the security assistance was very important to the Ukrainians. They had begun to hear from Ambassador Sondland that the security assistance was not going to come until the investigations were pursued.
So testimony there from Bill Taylor yesterday. Let's go to David, who's calling in from Wilmington. David, go right ahead.
Yeah, I've been watching the impeachment proceedings, and they remind me of the Blasey Ford, Kavanaugh Fugazi, the Cohen Fugazi, the Mueller Fugazi, and the more recent Kavanaugh Fugazi that all went nowhere. It seems like they're just trying to make a mountain out of a molehill by repeating the same fabricated story over and over until they actually believe it themselves.
Which part do you think is fabricated?
all of it. I mean, we don't even know who the whistleblower is. Is there a whistleblower? Maybe not. But being, you know, what I've seen from the Democratic Party in the last 3 years, I'm inclined to think there isn't even a whistleblower.
So does it matter to you if the whistleblower's identity is revealed? I mean, from what the hearings show and the transcript of the call, it sounds like there is sort of independent verification of each accusation the whistleblower has made from other people. So does that relieve you of some skepticism or no?
No. Who's the whistleblower? The whistleblower has to come out. There has to be a real whistleblower.
All right. So David wants to know who the real whistleblower is. I appreciate your perspective, David. Sue is calling in from Essex, New York. Sue, what are you thinking and questioning?
Yes. Hi. I'm a former Republican and an Elise Stefanik constituent, and she is on the House Intelligence Committee. And I find that she and the other Republicans are very complicit about all of this. And it's depressing. Trump sought foreign powers and the involvement in elections. And there are some serious military and national security issues that need to be dealt with. And people like David are worried about the whistleblower. It's like, are you kidding me? Mm. You know, I guess the question was asked yesterday about whether attempted bribery and extortion is an issue. Is it a crime? Yeah, we know that bribery is a crime in the Constitution, so maybe the professor can answer that. Is attempted bribery?
Sue, thanks for the call. What do you think? Linda Fowler, attempted bribery, is that a crime? And when we're talking about crimes here, we're also talking about constitutional process, not crimes in a court of law.
Well, crimes in a court of law include bribery and extortion mm-hmm. and campaign law violations. But I said, as I said earlier, the Justice Department has taken the position that a president can't be prosecuted for crimes while in office. The president has said he actually can't even be investigated for possible crimes. And so the constitutional remedy is impeachment. And where we are right now, I want to tell all of your listeners that impeachment is not a trial. Mm-hmm. Impeachment is like a grand jury investigation, which, by the way, happens behind closed doors to protect people who are accused. And so the whole point of impeachment is to set up whether there is a need for a trial, which would be in the Senate, and at which point there would be witnesses called on both sides. So I think you have to understand that impeachment is really a fact-finding operation. And where we seem to be as a nation right now, and this is not the first time we've seen this, is that people have their own understanding of the facts, that there's no such thing as a fact anymore in politics. And I think that's really the problem. I was thinking in the parts that I did watch, what's so interesting to me is that this whole thing, the president's fixation on Ukraine as a source of aid to Democrats in the 2016, comes out of right-wing conspiracy theories, an effort to say that the server that hacked the DNC was not in Russia, it was in Ukraine. And his dislike of the ambassador, a very well-respected State Department official, was fed by conspiracy theories that she had a secret list of people in the Ukraine who were to not be prosecuted because they were valuable to the Democrats. I guess part of my brain says if the president weren't so gullible and so easily manipulated by conspiracy theories, the country could have been spared this whole mess.
I want to play another clip for you, Professor Fowler, because one of the things that was interesting to us as we were watching and listening yesterday was the role of Republican Representative Elise Stefanik of New York. And I think Sue brought this up in her call a moment ago as well. So she tangled repeatedly, this is Stefanik, not Sue, with Adam Schiff throughout the hearing, including directly after George Kent and Bill Taylor were first sworn in.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Let the record show that the witnesses answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and please be seated.
Mr. Chairman, before we hear from the witnesses, I have a parliamentary inquiry.
The gentleman will state her parliamentary inquiry.
Mr. Chairman, when can we anticipate a response to our November 9th letter requesting certain individual witnesses to be called?
The gentlewoman should be aware that three of the witnesses the minority has requested are scheduled for next week.
Those were your witnesses, Mr. Chairman. What about the additional six witnesses?
The gentlewoman may inquire about additional witnesses or make a request for a vote on additional witnesses following the witness testimony.
So that was before we had even heard from Kent or Taylor, and then we heard from Stefanik as well later on. Linda Fowler, you know, that must have been planned that way, right? I mean, this was not Elise Stefanik going out on a limb by herself.
Yeah.
So how does that work? And why do you think they may have chosen her, who has been a critic of President Trump in the past, as the person sort of going on the offensive?
Well, a couple of reasons I think are illustrated there. The Republicans have had difficulty agreeing on a strategy. I've counted about five. The first was denial, this never happened. The second was the phone call happened, but it was innocent. The third was the phone call happened, but it doesn't rise to an impeachable offense. Where we are now is the phone calls happened and all the other things around it happened, but Trump really didn't have anything to do with it. And so the facts are really not helping the Republicans. And so in that situation, if you want to defend your president, and Republicans, many of them do, because he's very popular in their party. And I think we all need to understand that. So if the facts are not helpful to you, what you do is go after process. And so this secret whistleblower is raised as being an unfair process. Or the fact that the Republicans didn't get all the witnesses that they wanted is described as unfair. When the hearings were secret, that was a process problem because they were secret. Now that they're public, there are problems with that because the hearings are undermining the president. So when you have a weak case, factually, this is what you do. And of course, it was planned.
You mentioned when you have a weak case. So but looking ahead, and again, we're right at the beginning, and we're not, this isn't even, you know, we're not even into the removal procedure itself. But do you think that moving forward, there is any likelihood of this going to the Senate and of the president potentially actually being removed from office, given the makeup of the Senate?
Well, we've never removed a president from office.
Right.
We've only had three impeachment inquiries. The one president who was removed was Richard Nixon, and he resigned voluntarily. And I don't see Mr. Trump doing that. When I say the Republicans have a weak case, the facts are not very friendly to their case. I haven't made up my mind about impeachment yet. Because I think an important part of the hearing is simply laying out what this administration has been up to in terms of utilizing the taxpayers' money. And it's highly questionable. Once those facts are out there, even if the president doesn't get impeached or doesn't get convicted if impeached, there is important information out there that may be relevant in the 2020 election. It may be the case that the House will opt to censure the president. I really don't know yet. I'm trying to keep an open mind.
Do you think that's the motivation of the House to get more information out before a general election? And is that, not a fair use of the process?
Well, the House didn't really want to have this inquiry. The Democrats think that in the end this will mobilize the president's base. But I think the accumulation of facts, once the whistleblower complaint started being investigated, they really couldn't turn a blind eye to it for political reasons because it might hurt them with the election. If the Congress lets something like this go unchallenged and lets a president basically defy subpoenas, then they might as well just go home. Now, I think a lot of people think they should. They're not held in very high esteem. But that's a constitutional problem at the root of what we're seeing right now.
Well, at the very least, it's all totally fascinating. And Professor Fowler, I really appreciate your expertise and thoughts on this as we go through it. So thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to listen to your viewers. They're always so thoughtful. Thanks.
I agree. That's Linda Fowler, a professor of government at Dartmouth College.